the high cost of higher education. Education might be the key to a brighter financial future, but the cost of a secondary degree is out of reach for many. Or is it? I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll explore ways that students and their families can plan for the day they start writing checks, often very big checks, to a college or university, and how they might limit future student loan debt by getting the most financial aid possible. In the studio with me, John Bowie, Director of Financial Aid at Southern Maine Community College, Martha Johnston, Director of Education Services and Outreach at the Finance Authority of Maine, and Michael Bartini, Incoming Director of Student Aid at Bowdoin College. And we'd like to hear from you. Email talk@mpbn.net, post a question to our Facebook page, tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. A crash course in financial aid. This is Maine Calling. And welcome to our guests. We're going to begin now with Michael Bartini. Michael, welcome. You're at Bowdoin College, incoming finance guy. Is that your, what's your title exactly?
Director of Financial Aid.
Director of Financial Aid. In the interest of full disclosure, Bowdoin College is my alma mater. How much is Bowdoin going to be next year?
Bowdoin is just under $60,000. It's approximately $58,000, and that's inclusive of tuition fees, room and board, as well as books and supplies and other personal expenses.
So listeners will just hear that number. That's often the one number that everyone focuses on, and they might gasp and say, that's out of reach. You understand that reaction, but I guess your message is, hey, don't just look at that number.
Absolutely. What a family really needs to look at is the net price, and the net price would be our cost minus any financial aid that they might receive. In order to apply for financial aid, the student has to fill out the appropriate forms, but all of our aid is based on need, and quite frankly, that $58,000 can be something significantly less, depending on the family's financial circumstances.
But there are some families that are paying the full load, the full $58,000.
Oh, there are. They're becoming fewer and fewer. We have more and more students on financial aid each year. And the wonderful part of a place like Bowdoin is that we do have the resources to be able to distribute to students who have need.
John Bowie, you're Director of Financial Aid at Southern Maine Community College. I assume the tuition's significantly less than Bowdoin.
Just a little bit, you could say.
How much is it for next year?
Well, they haven't set the rates yet for next year. The current year's rates are $86 per credit hour for tuition for an in-state resident and $172 for an out-of-state resident.
That seems much less shocking to people who, particularly in this, you know, after 2008, we're all struggling to get out of this recession. Are you finding that community college students are choosing your school for reasons of it has the education they're looking for, or the price is right?
I think it's both, to be honest with you, Keith. We've certainly, and it's not just our community college, but I think it's all the Maine community colleges have seen an upswing in enrollment the last few years. We're certainly at our highest enrollment we've ever been at. We're around, I want to say, around 7,500 students this past year.
Martha Johnston of Finance Authority of Maine, please settle a dispute for me. Between the two camps that I perceive among families that are planning for their child's future education, in camp one is the group that says, my child is two or three, I'm going to start saving now in an account, and by the time they're ready, I'll have it and we'll be all set. Then there's camp two that says, we're not going to save a thing, we're going to be poor and maximize the potential for getting financial aid. I think I know the answer to this, but which camp do you fall into?
I might quiz you and ask, but camp one, that's always going to serve the family much better if they start saving early or if they start saving at all. It's never too late to start saving. And in terms of the biggest myth we have to bust is that somehow having savings is going to hurt your eligibility for financial aid. It is actually not going to hurt your eligibility for financial aid, and it provides you more options, especially when it comes to making choices between borrowing or not borrowing, and we'd rather not see you borrow.
It seems like there's this one of the arguments of Camp 2 is that, well, if I present these assets and I go to a school, they're just going to reach in, grab that off the top, and I will have really had no benefit there.
But right, and that's a common fallacy. But really what happens is there's actually a formula that takes into consideration how many assets need to be protected, if you will. So, for instance, the age of the older parent plays a significant part in that. The idea being that a parent is closer to retirement, more of their assets are actually protected off the top first. And then what's left after an asset protection allowance is looked at a very small percent, much smaller than people can even imagine.
Michael Bartini, would you give the same advice to parents?
I actually would. And the wonderful thing today is that as a mandate that is coming into play from last year is and it's every institution has what they call a net price calculator. So if a family wants to estimate what it would cost them to go to a particular institution, they can go to that institution's website, put in their financial information, and come back with some reasonably sound information about their family financial situation.
Debt is getting a lot of attention in the headlines, and for good reason. We're finding some students going out into the world with so much debt and in some cases, slim employment prospects, and that is combined into a kind of a grim picture. Is there a, and this is to any of you, I guess, is there a magic number beyond which a graduating student should not go, a ratio of debt to salary, a ratio of debt to tuition, some number to focus on?
I'll go ahead and try a first shot on that answer. Typically, when we're counseling students about planning long term, so where will they be at the end of 2 or 4 years, depending on the type of degree they're pursuing, we say a good rule of thumb is that their monthly student loan payment should be no more than 8 to 10% of their gross monthly income. And that's a rule of thumb that we use just to help them gauge.
Michael?
With regard to debt level, the advice that we give, first of all, is that in our standard financial aid packages, we do not package loans. So we encourage a student not to take loans. But it gets more complicated than that. And the reason it gets complicated is because the student loan may serve a purpose, an immediate purpose. And quite frankly, there might be an opportunity for the student to pay it back without much effort. But also other family members may be able to help the student out when it comes time to repayment. So it's more complicated than saying there's just one amount.
Well, I was going to say, we've heard stories about schools coming forward and saying, look, we're replacing all loans with outright grants. But that doesn't mean that mom or dad might not be on the hook for a loan.
Absolutely. There's always going to be a family share, and it's a question of how the family's going to be able to take care of that share. Sometimes they'll take it out of savings. Sometimes they'll take it out of current cash. But quite frankly, many families will choose to borrow that money, either from a parent perspective or from a student perspective.
John Bowie, even with the significantly less debt, I'm guessing, coming out of Southern Maine Community College, is paying for college amongst your students a concern still, though, as well?
Oh, absolutely. What people tend to think about sometimes when they think about students borrowing or paying for college is they're thinking about just the tuition fees, things like that. But a lot of your students that go full-time, for example, they can't necessarily work full-time while they're going to school, so they need to look at financial aid as a way to supplement their living expenses. And that's where we see a lot of our students taking on some student loans as well. Our loan volume has certainly gone up in the last few years, as I think a lot of colleges have.
Are you seeing older students as well in the mix who
Yes.
not only can't work while they're studying, but may have a mortgage and a car payment and maybe even a kid in school?
We see all of those things. Especially at a community college, you see a lot of what we like to call non-traditional age students coming back from the work. They've been let go from the workplace, and they're coming back into school. I would say it's a 50-50 mix. I see a lot of both. And I think in some ways it is harder for those adult students who have families of their own that are trying to make a go of it, paying for things, and keeping up with their own financial obligations that they've had.
Let's anticipate some of the questions we might get from callers and run a scenario. Let's just say I'm 52. I haven't really saved anything for my 6-year-old son's education. yet, and I'm wondering what I should do. Hey, this sounds familiar. What should be the first step I might consider? Is it a savings account or some planning process, Martha?
You know, I would say yes. You definitely want to jump on starting some kind of savings right away, and there's a whole host of options that are available to you. And certainly one thing a lot of people consider is a 529 college savings account, which is a tax-advantaged way to save for college. So when you do use that money for that now 18-year-old, no longer 6-year-old, what you take out and any earnings would not be taxed. So, yes, I think jumping on a savings plan, and I think jumping on a systematic savings plan so that you kind of set it on automatic and forget it, and just keep contributing every month.
How much would you recommend putting in?
You know, that's probably a tougher question, but I would say anything that you can reasonably afford to put away, I would start to do that right away.
So there's no number.
There's no magic number, yeah. Because I think all of the things that Mike and John have alluded to, every situation's different, every college is different, the costs are different, the students' needs are different. And even the family's ability to borrow or not borrow might be different, or to do a payment plan. So it's almost like putting together a mosaic of all your different financing options, and savings is one of them.
And are there different types of accounts, or?
Well, 529 is a section of the IRS code, so there's certainly various plans throughout the nation, and most states sponsor a plan, and Maine does have a plan, and it's got great Maine benefits. And so we encourage families. The biggest thing is to just make sure that you start saving as soon as you can. But don't just assume that you shouldn't save because you didn't start early.
Michael and John, do schools have programs where you can, even at the young age of 6, have some sort of savings relationship with a school? You're not guaranteed to get in, but...
Schools don't have programs generally, but states do. And so throughout the country, you're going to find out that many states have savings programs as well as tuition savings programs that could benefit the student should their child end up going to school in that particular state or in some cases any school.
All right, we're going to take an earlier break than usual and start letting callers come into the conversation. We're going to, as we take a break, when we come back, we'll have your comments and questions. Share your thoughts. Email talk@mpbn.net. Tweet @MaineCalling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or call 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Peter Beinart talks about his new book, The Crisis of Zionism. He supports Israel but thinks the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are compromising Israel's commitment to democracy. He's proposed a boycott of goods made in those Jewish settlements. We'll get a response from Gary Rosenblatt, editor and publisher of the Jewish Week of New York. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Of the many valued public affairs programs on MPBN television, Charlie Rose is well known for his informative and intelligent interviews with notable individuals and newsmakers. Charlie Rose can be seen twice daily on MPBN television, 4:30 each weekday afternoon and 11 at night. See our television schedule at mpbn.net for more information.
For almost half a century, Head Start programs have helped kids in poverty, with varying levels of success. Now the Obama administration wants faltering programs to shape up or lose their funding.
Obama wants all Head Start programs in the country to go up for recompetition or whatever it is. Bring it on.
Head Start programs compete to survive. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this evening at 4 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about paying for the cost of a college education. And our guests in the studio, John Boy, Director of Financial and Southern Maine, Director of Financial Aid at Southern Maine Community College, Martha Johnston, Director of Education Services and Outreach at Finance Authority of Maine, and Michael Bartini, incoming director of student aid at Bowdoin College. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. And we'll take your calls in just a moment. Let's see. I guess I'm wondering, we were talking before the break about savings accounts. So what if I just haven't been able to do that for whatever reason, and my child is 15 and college is a few years away? Not too late to start a savings account, or are there other steps that at that point I now need to start taking, Martha?
I would say it's hands down, over and over, I'll tell you the same thing. It's never too late to save, because even if that limited time period allows you to help the child save only for books or travel expenses or indirect costs, that's what we call them, not directly billed by the college or university, again, that's some dollar that they won't necessarily have to borrow. And so we just think you'd never want to look at it that you've given up the ship already. Even if it's just $10 a week or $10 a month, start saving and really get your child engaged too, working, earning, saving, so that they're part of that process too. So by age 15, they should be helping out with that as well.
All right, let's try a call from Belfast and Tom. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I very much support creative ways of helping people think about how to fund college. What I did with my children was I was fortunate to have some very good students, but I may stay on the honor roll and striving for scholarships. Their duty, their job in high school, I said, if you do that, then I'll help pay for college. They also contribute by earning scholarships. And then when they went to college, they both worked as freshmen and through college to support their living expenses. Everyone should remember, as was already mentioned in the program, it's the cost of living for room and board and rent that even though we had scholarships, we had easily $12,000 to $13,000 a year per student just to keep them clothed and fed. So good luck, everybody.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for the encouragement, Tom. And one second, folks, while I flip a switch here. There we go. And we're going to go to Kennebunk and Patrick. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Keith. Thanks for taking my call this afternoon.
Yes, go ahead.
I was just calling in to make a general comment. I'm a 43-year-old college student at the community college level, transferring on to USM in the fall full-time. One of the biggest obstacles I'm facing is trying to maintain the financial obligations that I face today, you know, with cars and family and mortgage while going to school full-time. And there doesn't seem to be any assistance available to somebody in my shoes.
John, you want to go?
No. Patrick, that's a really good question. And as you know, I work at a community college, and we see that a lot with students in your situation. We see students trying to qualify for as much grant assistance as they can through the Pell Grant. And if you haven't filed your FAFSA yet for next year, make sure you do it by May 1st so you can potentially qualify for the State of Maine grant. But we do see a lot of students that are having to turn to student loans because the grants cover a lot of times the tuition and fees, but the loans are what cover their living obligations. And really, I mean, there's not a lot of federal assistance at the grant level that's going to cover all those things. So that's why a lot of students have to turn to the student loans.
Yeah. So, thank you.
Patrick, let's bring in Sherry Gallion, who is scholarship manager at the Maine Community Foundation, joining us by phone. Hi, Sherry. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
We wanted to invite you into the conversation here to talk about scholarships that Maine Community Foundation offers.
Yes, absolutely. The foundation has over 450 scholarship funds that serve students at every level, from very small funds at a very local level to larger statewide funds. And last year we gave out $1.5 million across the state in scholarship funds.
So, and are these, to qualify for these, do you have to fit a certain profile? We have a caller from Kennebunk, Patrick, who's a 43-year-old college student at USM looking for financing.
Yes, most of them do. Actually, all of them do to a certain degree. These funds are set up by individual donors, and so these funds do represent the interests of that particular, you know, donor or the person behind the fund. We do have some funds that are for returning students or adult learners, non-traditional students. The vast majority, unfortunately, are for graduating seniors of high schools, which doesn't help folks like Patrick. But they are restricted according to maybe a field of interest or the town that you reside in. So most of them do have some restrictions on them.
Okay, and how do you find out about them?
The easiest way to find out about our funds is on our website, which is www.maincf.org, and we have a listing there by county, which is the easiest way to find our funds. But I know that the Finance Authority of Maine also has a really excellent scholarship database search on their website. And for high school students, I always recommend that they talk to their guidance counselors, who really have the best information, especially about local scholarships that are available.
And we'll have links to all of those on our Maine Calling Facebook page. Yeah, John.
As well, for the folks out there, I definitely would recommend when you're looking at a particular college, look at their financial aid office webpage as well. A lot of colleges will have, if they have any institutionally funded scholarships or through college foundations, they will have the scholarship pages on the website, applications, things like that that students can fill out. And they'll also have links to a lot of the search engines that are out there, like the FAME scholarship database and other ones out there. So definitely, one thing I've always told families is always research your financial aid department at the school you're going to and look at what their pages say.
We have a message on Facebook from a listener who asks, I'm about to graduate with about $30,000 in federal student loans. Will I be eligible for graduate loans if I consolidate? Anybody want to tackle that?
I'm assuming that they're graduating with a bachelor's degree and they want to go on to graduate school. I don't think they need to worry necessarily about consolidating, although consolidating can be a good idea just to help manage a person's loan debt. But when you go on to graduate school, the federal loan limits go up considerably from what they are for an undergraduate student. And I would recommend that this person speak specifically with the financial aid department at the college that they're looking at for graduate school to see if there's anything like any graduate assistantships, tuition waivers, things like that. And they can also advise them on the best options for their loans.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation to Portland. And Tim, hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
So I'm a law student. I'm just about to graduate in May with about $125,000 in debt. I do get in-state tuition. And you've been talking a lot about ways that people can cover these high costs, but I was wondering what you might think about any responsibilities or any ways that we could try and reduce the cost of education and not just try and reach these exorbitant sums of money that it costs to go to these higher education institutions these days.
We could maybe bring in Michael Bartini of Bowdoin College here, not to pick on you, Michael, every time we talk about expensive schools. But what about that? You know, I assume parents and students look at a Bowdoin and they see new buildings and, beautiful grounds, and they wonder kind of what is causing this ballooning cost.
There's a couple things always to remember when you think about the cost of education. The answer to your question is, could we reduce the costs? Absolutely. But it would change the product. And quite frankly, the demand for the product indicates that families are really interested in what we have to offer. When you think about all the academic offerings and opportunities that we provide to students, they cost money. Our student-faculty ratios, which are very low, allow us to be able to have have the student experience that is actually quite expensive. So there are ways in which we could reduce the cost of education. The thing that many folks don't understand also is that, you know, while our prices are high, quite frankly, on a per-student basis, it costs significantly more to offer the product that we do. But through the generosity of our alumni, we've been able to keep the prices at what they are. So the answer to your question is yes, certainly we could do that, but it would dramatically change the product.
Tim, do you have any sense of how long it will take you to pay off your law degree?
Well, you know, it depends on, I guess, what I do. If I were to work in the public sector, it could take me, you know, 10 years with some of the, you know, financial incentives from the federal government. If not, you know, 20 years plus probably.
Did you just share with us your sort of thought process when you entered into that? did you want so much to be a lawyer that it was sort of to heck with the debt, or did you struggle with it?
Well, I mean, that was part of it, and it was something that I'd always wanted to do, and it just seemed like, well, this is the only way to do it. This is the least expensive way. I mean, I could have easily spent $250,000 if I had gone to a different school, but the financial part came into it, but it just sort of seemed like a bit of an investment that hopefully will reap returns in my future life.
All right. Well, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Martha, go ahead.
I just want to thank you, Tim, for bringing up the federal programs. What you were referring to in particular was public service loan forgiveness. And hearing you talk about your own situation reminded me that for many professional students, whether they're lawyers or doctors or working in some other health profession, they really need to also make sure that they explore something called student loan repayment. So it might be that you did incur that debt to do your professional degree, but there could be some opportunities for you to take a public service job where a portion of your student loan is actually paid off. And the Finance Authority Maine actually runs programs like that for public service attorneys and also for dentists practicing in underserved areas. And so those are things not to forget about either, but I applaud your comment and question about keeping the cost down.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Now to Yarmouth and Roger. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the program.
Oh, that's good. All right. Good luck. Have a lot of fun.
Roger.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
Thanks for meeting me over here.
Roger, Roger, you're on the air.
Who?
Hi, Roger.
Yes, hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thanks. Sorry, I was meeting somebody. Two questions. One is it worthwhile for parents to engage the services of the private companies that assist in financing for their children? And also, are there any basically immediate benefits to putting funds into the 529s for parents, year to year as far as tax incentives go?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Michael?
Roger, I'll take care of the first one. I believe you're saying, does it make sense for you to go pay money to have somebody help you fill out financial aid forms and navigate the process? My immediate answer is no. And what I would encourage you to do is either through your school, your community organization, or through the state, find out about all the free services that are available. If after that you're having trouble, then my next course of action would say, okay, what's your first or second choice school? Why don't you go and sit down and talk to the financial aid directors at those particular institutions? If I have one pet peeve about the admissions processes is that students will go out of their way to get themselves on college campuses. They have questions about financial aid, but they hardly ever go over to the financial aid office. So I would encourage you to go the free route first and don't necessarily believe that you need to engage in a service that would cost you a particular fee.
Okay.
And great. The second part of the question, I think, was about are there any immediate tax benefits of a 529?
So I'll weigh in on the second part of the question, but I actually might echo a couple things that Mike just said about the first part, which is the Finance Authority of Maine is one of those agencies that Mike was referring to where we offer those same kind of free services. So if you're just looking generally, FAME is a great place to start. But then, as Mike said, as you get closer to narrowing down that first or second choice, going to the college or university directly is also a great option. Regarding the 529, I would say always consult any tax professional that you work with to see what aspect of a 529 might be appropriate for your current financial situation. I will say that even if your son or daughter is in their teens and you're a Maine resident, the 529 program in Maine actually has wonderful matching grant programs, which we like to refer to as basically money on the table, and you wouldn't want to leave it there. So, for instance, a Maine resident that opens a 529 account sponsored in Maine, it happens to be called NextGen, FAME will actually provide a $200 match for your $50 contribution to open that account. So when you think about benefits and grants and state-administered programs, don't forget those types of options as well.
Right.
Thank you for calling. Sherry Gallion, you've been waiting patiently there on the phone with us, and we'll let you go in a moment. Anything else you wanted to add before you?
The only thing that I would add is really encouraging anyone who thinks they might be eligible for a scholarship to apply. What we hear from guidance counselors and our own experience suggests that really students are not applying for scholarships at the level they could be. The purpose of a scholarship is to help cut into either the gap that a student has between their financial aid and the true cost of attending college, or to help cut down on that debt that you were talking about earlier. And every little bit really does help, and so I would strongly encourage everyone to look into their options and make sure that they apply for that where they are eligible.
All right, Sherry Gallion, Scholarship Manager at the Maine Community Foundation, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take another quick break, and when we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, new websites putting up small jobs for bid or micro labor are on the rise. Clean my compost bin, buy my dog food. Desperate Americans are bidding low. Where does this go? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point this evening at midnight. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Verrill Dana, proud to serve their clients and their communities for 150 years, online at verrilldana.com. Join us after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. Guests include humor columnist Dave Barry and writer Alan Zweibel, both the co-authors of the book Lunatics. That's at 1 o'clock, the Commonwealth Club of California, here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we're talking about paying for college. Our guest, John Bowie, Director of Financial Aid, Southern Maine Community College. Martha Johnston, Director of Education Services and Outreach at the Finance Authority of Maine. And Michael Bartini, Incoming Director of Student Aid at Bowdoin College, and you as well, the listeners. Let's go to John in Brewer. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello. My question has got to do with the cost of attendance, sort of like that other caller. I've read articles how the cost of attendance for schools has risen in generally to 1100 to 1400%. It's outstripping inflation. It's outstripping the economy. It's outstripping the cost of living. And the product, which is the education, stays the same. We still have the same degree. We still have the same qualifications. So how are these bigger schools or private universities justifying the incredibly large increase in their charge to the student where it doesn't line up with anything else that they've got going on?
Okay, and we sort of addressed this earlier, but I'm sensing that people maybe are not buying into the answer. Any of you want to respond to that?
They're not buying it for a second.
Okay. Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
So one of the things I think to consider in that discussion, too, is the sources of aid and where they come from. And when you consider the difference between private and public, remember many states are having a very difficult time these days. And so consequently, they're not able to provide the type of support to higher education that they have in the past. When state subsidies are cut back, there is no choice but for an institution to raise their fees in order to cover those differences. So those are some of the things that are going on. And as I said earlier in the program, too, I think whether it's private or public, you really want to focus on net cost. And net cost is very personal because if it's based on a need basis, it's going to be based on your economic situation. So what's the cost of that particular institution that you're interested in minus what you would be able to get. So I think net cost would help a little bit in thinking about the total cost.
So, but to John's point, when I was at Bowdoin in 1982, I think the annual tuition cost was like $11,000. I don't remember what the cost of living, the cost of things were in 1982. I think what John is suggesting is that the $11,000 in 1982 does not translate to $60,000 in 2012. But do we know that?
We do. And without being able to state particular figures, another thing to consider, too, is what we're doing in higher education, the way in which we deliver it. It's very people-driven. And so consequently, in order to stay competitive, you need to have competitive salaries for faculty.
And competitive campuses and pools and athletic fields and all. Doesn't all that play in as well?
All of those things certainly come into play when you look at the cost. And again, as I stated earlier, is it sure, we could put a different product on the street at a cost that's less than what it is today. But the difficult part is that that's not what the public really wants.
John, are you still with us?
Yes.
What's your reaction?
The public who sees student loan debt surpassing credit card debt for the first time in history, what would you say to all those public, all the public who thinks that you guys are just riding the next bubble till it bursts?
Is there a bubble there? Or what I hear is that schools also went through, many of them lost a lot of money in their own accounts in 2008 and are coming back as well. But I'll let our guests answer that question.
You know, what I do often when I work with students about college access issues and talking about the cost of education, I really try to get them to challenge themselves to think about what their expectations are for their education and also for the career or the credential that they're pursuing, so that they really explore the whole range of costs. Because it could be that for the field that they want to pursue, there is a perfectly viable lower cost public option. And I think the other thing to remember about student loan debt is that as consumers, when you take out that debt, try to use all the tools that are available to you to make informed decisions, so that at the end of the process, you don't feel that you were just caught up in the flow and you couldn't stop, but that you actually really tried to look at all the sources. And I know that's not easy, but, you know, you've got to kind of become part of the process and make those decisions in an informed way.
Now let's go back to some practical questions now with Jim, who's calling from Orono and has a question about FAFSA. You can't get through a conversation about paying for college without the FAFSA. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call, Keith. Yes, I'd like to understand how the FAFSA works a little better. Specifically, I have two teenagers, and we've funded their Coverdell education savings accounts since they were born to the full amount available. And I have in my hand an envelope with their contribution for 2011, and I was planning on making that from their uniform gift to minors custodial account that they have, because it's my understanding that custodial accounts can be harmful in the FAFSA formula. And so I'm planning on trying to lower the balance in the custodial account and send that to the education savings account. And the second part of my question would be, if a household has any discretionary income and you're already contributing the maximum amount to a Coverdell education savings account, should you take that income and put it into your retirement account? Again, in order to optimize your financial picture for the FAFSA formula.
All right, let's let our guests weigh in. We also do have an email from Mary in Orono who writes and says, despite the assurances of your guests, families are indeed penalized for saving for college. And she goes through kind of what happened to her. Her kids were denied after they had saved some money. Let's respond to some of the caller's questions. Who'd like to start?
So, Jim, I'll take the part about, saving and using a Coverdell and whether it's important to have it in the student side with the custodial account or in a Coverdell where it gets treated as a parent asset. The important part, if you really want my opinion, you're saving. And the vehicle for which you save, there are advantages at the back end in the formula. There's also advantages on the front end potentially with regard to your tax liability. So the good news is that you're saving. I think the other thing that you can do too is that you, as I mentioned earlier about the net price calculator, there is no mystery in the way in which we treat income and assets. So please feel free to go to ours or some other net price calculator and play around with your numbers, whether they be on the asset side for the parent or the student, and see how those dollars convert into a contribution down at the end. I don't expect that you want to become an expert on the formulas, but it does help you give a sense of, if I do this in my particular situation, these are the results that are going to happen. And my only other comment in that Keith had earlier from the person writing in is that whenever you save something, it's a guarantee. You've got it. Otherwise, you're betting against the future that somebody's going to be able to help you. I think given today's economic circumstances, a lot of folks have found out that, you know, that's not the best bet. And so savings does assure that you have something in your pocket that you can rely on.
We've got about 3 minutes left. I want to work in a couple of quick calls to Waterville and Joan. Hi, Joan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask, I'm a former retired professor and I'm now a social worker. I'm concerned that the public should be informed about the $1 trillion debt and the inability for millions of students. There's many websites now that students have come together and talked about how they can't pay their loans out due to usurious charges and capitalized interest. Some people, saw someone on ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com this morning, Ben, who has over $210,000 in debt. And this is a very serious problem. Has anybody informed you or are anyone aware of H.R. 4170, the Student Loan Forgiveness Act of 2012?
Okay, let's respond really quickly because we're running out of time, Joan. So go ahead. Martha?
Sure. I go back again. I agree. I think that the amount of debt that students are taking out for education, we're looking at something that really needs to get reined in. And I think the student can become part of that process. And the way I think they can become part of that process is through making informed decisions before they take out that debt. And again, I stated this earlier when we were speaking with another caller, but I think it's really incumbent upon the student to research all their options, really challenge themselves based on the job they want, the credential they're trying to earn, and really take a look at what they are likely able to support in student loan debt before they make that choice. And so there's a lot of what we call salary debt calculators out there. There's many great tools for students so that they don't feel victimized through the process, but they become part of the process and they make great choices. And that's what I'd advocate for.
I'm not sure we're going to have time to go to Bob and Gorham, but he's asking, no one has mentioned military and GI Bill or online degrees or the old system of being in a guild. There certainly are other alternatives to this conventional system that you all represent.
Yeah, I would say, Bob, I applaud your comment. I'm so glad you made it. I recommend if you go out to the FAME website or any other website, most colleges and universities might have a section for veterans or military benefits. We certainly do on our website, and I think he's right. Explore every option, turn over every rock, and look under every leaf.
All right, we're out of time. John, Martha, Michael, thanks for joining us. John Bowie, Director of Financial Aid, Southern Maine Community College. Martha Johnston, Director of Education Services and Outreach, Finance Authority of Maine. And Michael Bartini, Incoming Director of Student Aid at Bowdoin College. We also, thanks to Sherry Gallion, Scholarship Manager at Maine Community Foundation. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith and our volunteer Cindy Hahn. Cindy answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from volunteer Scott McAuliffe and the MPBN web team. You can listen to this conversation and previous editions of the show by visiting mpbn.net. I'm Keith Shortall, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.